Mobile. He'd have to get under, get out and get under to fix his little machine. He was just dying to cuddle his queen, but every minute when he'd begin it, he'd have to get under, get out and get under. Then he'd get back at the wheel. It seems that once she sat down on his knee, and then he lost control, ran right up a tree, and then he had to get under, get out and get under, and fix up his automobile.
Good evening, good evening. Bernie Golias here, and you're listening to The Auto Era. And The Auto Era is a weekly show here, if you haven't heard it already. And what we do is we talk about automotive history. And Cleveland has a lot of automotive history. There's been over 115 various vehicles built in northern Ohio, and 80 of them right within the city limits. And if you've been listening to the show, we talked quite a bit about, my favorite topic, Winton. And we talked about Templer, and we also Stearns and a variety of others, and we have a lot of other cars. When you have, you know, there was over 2,000-3,000 automobiles, and that's quite a few of them all over the United States. There's a lot of cars that, a lot of repertoire, so to speak. Not that many people are experts, though, on all of them, and we've had quite a few experts on the show. But anyway, that's what we do. We and we also we occasionally break through and the barriers and extend over the various boundaries of northern Ohio and talk worldly. And tonight we're going to do that with our guest, and I'm going to introduce him to you. His name's Steve Pressman, and he is going to talk tonight about military vehicle history. And I'd like to introduce to you Steve Pressman. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Glad to be here. And a little bit about myself. I served in the United States Army for 28 years. Early in my career, I spent a year as a military historian, and then the last year was 2011. I was a military historian for the state Ohio Military Reserve, which is part of the Adjutant General's Department, which aids in disaster services. But as a military historian, the field changed in the about 20 years since I had those two assignments. I'd say 20 years ago, a military historian would look up things that were interesting facts and assist people in finding history. It's like my stepfather was in the Korean War, and I was able to find him his divisional history and some information about where he was. And that's very helpful to individuals. Since 9/11, military historians have been basically examining the trends and the lessons learned from ongoing operations, so we don't make the same mistake twice, which is very critical in the the geopolitical environment that we have here today. And then, just as a disclaimer, nothing I say today is endorsed by either the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense or the Ohio Adjutant General's Department.
It's not all top secret. And you know what? If you want to, I want to give the number here just in case somebody like to talk to you, Steve. Write it down, 440-775-8139. You're listening to WOBC, Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. And we have this evening on the Auto Era, Steve Pressman, talking about military vehicle history.
And of course, what happens is we have the history of the state of Ohio, which our modern history started in 1778. And in the military today, everything is a system. And those of you out there, you know your car, and you know you have your brake system or your automatic braking system, your electrical systems, your air conditioning systems, of course your engine with the exhaust system, and I have a 2006 Subaru Forester. If you don't dog down the gas cap, then the computer thinks the EVAP system has a malfunction. And so all these systems work together. So even your average infantryman who's walking the hills of Afghanistan as we speak, what he's carrying as he walks alone is a system. And then to relate it to Ohio, that exact system walked into Ohio from Fort McIntosh, which is in Butler, PA, in 1778. And in those days, we were pre-industrial, and we had pre-industrial systems. There were little glimmers of industrial systems. So basically, you had an army that was lucky if it could move eight miles per day. And it took from Butler, PA, to North Canton, Ohio, where Fort Lawrence is. It must have took them like 3 and 4 and 5 weeks, depending on what they had to haul. They didn't have the road system. Our nation, basically, we depended upon schooners going from the major seaports and the smaller towns along the Atlantic seaboard. So this was the nation's transportation system. Of course, you had horses. Most people walked. That was what there was. And so, but surprisingly, they had enough technology. We had back in 1769, there was a Frenchman named Nicolas Joseph Cugnot, and he invented a steam tractor that they wanted to haul the heavy artillery of the French army. Of course, they loaded from the front end of that. And what happened is it was like electric cars are now today. They weren't getting the performance. I don't know what the duration of operation of the vehicle was or its range, but it weighed 3.9 tons, and it only went 2.5 miles per hour. Of course, the French army said, we've got cows that move faster. And that's what they stuck with for their heavy artillery, oxen and heavy draft horses, the old chevaliers, the old French draft horses, that were used in the 19th century to pull our beer trucks. But all the systems were there. You had the wheel, you had brakes, you had steam engines. It was not put together. And then the army was marching on shoes. You didn't have a left shoe and a right shoe. And nowadays I've got socks. I have a left sock and a right sock. They just had one shoe, and you could put them on either foot, and they weren't differentiated. Then we had 40 years went by, and then steam engines for maritime use, they took off. We had the War of 1812, and we did have shoes for left and right. So that was the War of 1812. And before the War of 1812, and Bernie, you're going to like this, they had people in Philadelphia that made swords, which, of course, have nothing to do with automobiles. But I was in Medina. I was at the Medina, was the antique mall, and they had a sword for $2,500. There was a frog where you put the loop that went over the officer's shoulder, and it was a white band of cloth, and that was affixed with a little gray tin button, and that was made in Philadelphia probably about 1805, and it was made on progressive dyes. So, where I know Bernie from mostly is his work, which is the Metal Fab Corporation, and he's been doing this. He knows progressively formed metal. And that's like the heart of the coachmaking nowadays. In those days, and especially when we talk about the Wintons, you had coaches that were made with a wooden frame, and then they would face them with various materials. But you could see that pretty early on, we started to build an automotive industry, and that is what the military bought into. And so,
and how early, actually, what was the first, I know you were going to get into that. We got quite a bit of show here.
Yeah.
Now, but you're giving us a little prelude into the motorized vehicles.
Right. And that where that happened was where we start to come into the Civil War era, and we didn't have the road system. So a thing like Cuneau built, that sort of steam tractor wasn't going to work. So they had to put it on steel rails, and that worked because the power to weight ratio, when we talk about military vehicles, this is very important. So the Civil War was the first conflict that was really railroad centric in the history of the world. And that's what made it happen. The troops were still on shoes, and that's the way, mostly the way they marched. The Army was at the point where the Union forces was giving the infantryman a new pair of shoes every month, and they'd wear it out. They called them the foot cavalry, Sherman's troops, as they marched through the south towards Atlanta. But it was the railroads that took over, and it took over from other modes of transportation. Of course, you had the canals, and even in the 1840, the Army experimented with camels, and that didn't work out too good. But
if it was 20 below zero, it probably didn't work out too good, right?
Oh, you get your in that case, you get your Bactrian camels. Those are your Arctic systems.
Okay.
And then what happened was is that you had a Belgian engineer named Etienne Lenoir. He created the first internal combustion engine. And then Nicholas Otto in Cologne, Germany, he came up with the four-stroker. And most of these engines by 1877, this was the 1860s and then the 1870s, they were stationary farm engines. It was up to guys like Winton and Henry Ford and the Mercedes and Benz in Europe and all these early people that you've talked about in past shows to come up with working automobiles. And so where that left us was a few automobiles being used for here and there in 1898 for the Spanish-American War, and then we got into World War I. And so what that led to for Cleveland, Ohio, was a vehicle called the White Armored Car. It was developed in 1915, and they were 4x2, four wheels, only which two are powered. And as you know, most military vehicles are 4x4. This thing weighed, it weighed basically a three and a third tons. It had a machine gun. It would travel 65 miles an hour, and it was developed by the White Motor Company of Cleveland, Ohio. And it was probably the only vehicle that was probably pure Cleveland from that era. So it was good. It was used by the French in World War I. It was used by the United States Army. It was used by the Marines. The Model 1917 was used by the American Expeditionary Force in World War I. And most of these machine guns are carriers, as sometimes they were called. And all they were was basically a truck with a machine gun, very light armor. They were used to negotiate the intact roads in the rear area of communication. So if there were any infiltrators, they'd be able to catch those guys. The British used them to rescue their downed airmen. And surprisingly, they had a lot of tractability. They had good power to weight ratio. They had adequate armor and armament. And vehicles like the White Armored Car, the Rolls-Royce Armored Car, which was a British version, was used up until the 1940s in the Middle East. So that's it.
Well, you're listening to the Auto Era. I'm Bernie Golias, your host, and Steve Pressman is our guest. And this is WOBC Oberlin 91.5, Oberlin College and Community Radio. And our guest, Steve Pressman, is definitely a military historian, and we're talking about some of the various types of vehicles here that we're getting into for motorized type of vehicles used for the for military purposes. And one of the other things too, I know, Steve, when you're talking about the white, roughly 1915, during the First World War there, I think everybody was starting to get involved, because I know Winton built Browning and Hotchkiss machine gun tripods. I know that some of the cars were built for that purpose, purpose of being sent over to Europe. And of course, Packard was very big in sending cars over there. Peerless, I think, had one or two models. A lot of them were staff cars. And there's a couple that were just sold recently. One was just sold recently. I believe it was an early Pierce Arrow that was used by the officers. So, yeah, they started getting involved with it. And I know, you know, when you're talking about motorized infantry, a lot of these trucks and cars were sort of... guns and tank, whatever I'm thinking of here now. You know, they were customized. You know, they were initially, a lot of them were just simple cars, but then they started getting involved with tanks. And I know you probably want to start maybe mention a little bit about tanks. Germany, I know, was very big up on that with the Panzers and things like that. But you can go on and on, you know, how that goes. But anyway, that's, I just wanted to throw some things in there.
Yeah.
But
Yeah, one thing about my background also is that I spent 10 years in the cavalry with vehicles. We didn't have horses. In the 1980s, they were deemed to be too expensive, so we just made do with our vehicles. And we could discuss the Cleveland Cavalry in the 1930s and stuff like that. But when I was there, I took a motor officer course, and then I took a mechanics course called Duke's Army, where we went through all of our existing vehicles that we had in our cavalry unit, so the tracked vehicles and the wheeled vehicles. The other thing that's interesting about the white is originally it was armed with the M1895 Colt Browning machine gun. And then it had a 45 horsepower four-cylinder engine. So when we talk about power-to-weight ratio, you're moving 3 1/3 tons with 45 horsepower. We just don't do that nowadays. We have more powerful engines. But one thing that the white had that the first MRAPs used in Afghanistan and Iraq didn't have was leaf spring suspension. The original mine-resistant armored personnel carrying vehicles used in Iraq and Afghanistan were hardtails, so they didn't have suspensions. And when you imagine going down a bumpy road in a vehicle without a suspension. But in 1915, White gave this vehicle adequate suspension and adequate in ventilation for the crew. The first British tanks lacked that. And then as far as the tanks are concerned, there was a whole slew of tanks that were developed in World War One. There was the Ford Model 19, was a 3-ton, an M1918, and it was, had the war gone to 1919, we would have seen these tanks on the front in France. And then what's really interesting is Holt in the United States built a gas electric tank, and this was a hybrid, and it had a gasoline engine that was generating the electricity for the powertrain. So you had an motivated and controlled system. So you didn't have to worry. In other words, you had switches to steer by, not having heavy gears and levers like the early British tanks. The M1917 was an American production model of the Renault FT-17, and that was the one that General Patton used in France, and that's mostly the AEF used. And then there was an American version of the British called the Mark 8 International Liberty, and was powered by an American Liberty engine. The problem with these tanks were these were the Lausanne-shaped tanks with the treads that went over the body. You were living literally with the engine right in the compartment. We're talking it going 120 degrees. The tank wasn't very well sealed against shot. Communications were bad, and inside the tank because it was so noisy. And really, it's amazing that they were able to do as much as they did with these vehicles to break out at Cambrai like they did in, I believe, 1917, the British, with the first mass tank attack. And then there was the British Mark V that was also used by the Americans. But the real star and the real darling of World War I was the American Liberty truck, which was a series of vehicles. And if you remember the Deuce and a Half, most of the people out there who have been in the military in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and into the Gulf War, the Persian Gulf War, and then on to Afghanistan and Iraq, remember the Deuce and a Half. But the Deuce and a Half, its precursor was the Standard B Liberty truck. And there were about 17,000 of them built during the World War I. They were classed from 3 to 5 tons. They were an open cab, ragtop over the cargo compartment, and they carried a lot of good stuff. It used a 425 cubic inch L-head four-cycle 52-horsepower engine. Bernie, what would an average truck going down the road, a cargo truck that could carry about 5 tons, what would a international or, you know, just a civilian truck, what would be the horsepower of that engine, if you were to guess?
Oh, between 300 and 400.
300 and 400. So they're going down the road with 52 horsepower. They have a 4-speed transmission, and then it's a 4x2. Only two of the wheels are powered. It had a wheelbase of 160 and 0.5 inches. The length was 261 inches. The width was 84 inches. It was 75 inches high. It was high, and its curb weight was 3/5 of a ton. And just an amazing vehicle for the time. They had numerous variants, and there's numerous of these vehicles that you could see in the museums today.
Well, that's Steve Pressman, and we're talking about some military vehicle history here. And this is Bernie Golias, your host to the Auto Era, and this is WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. Well, I have a question for you, Steve, and if anybody else has a question, you can call in, because the lines are open at 440-775-8139. One of the things is when you start motorizing the military, or I should say, well, motorizing the military and mechanizing the machinery. We do have a couple calls coming. I have to get it. I'm the gentleman that pushes the buttons, answers the phones, and everything else here. So I'm going to get to the phone here. But let's see what's going on here. But my question is, were most of these vehicles, diesel was just coming out then, but most of them were probably still gasoline powered, right?
Well, most of them were, and up until the World War II era. World War II tankers used to call their tanks, a lot of cases, Ronsons, because they'd go up like a popular lighter that was in their pocket. You know, also Zippos would be a good example. And so these vehicles were powered by gasoline. And sometimes with gasoline oil mixes also, depending on the vehicle. And another interesting thing about the Liberty truck is that I was amazed that I had a diagnostic port on the Humvee when we got the Humvees in 1991. And I could unscrew this stuff, put a computer terminal into it, and I could troubleshoot the vehicle. The Liberty had an electrical troubleshooting lamp plug in there. It had an anemometer. And it also had, especially the Series 2, a simplified electrical system. They would actually literally run the vehicle on the magneto only. And so if you can imagine, you got to get your thing cranked up and you don't have a distributor, a battery, a generator, an electrical light system. You just got this magneto. When you crank it up, that starts it up and it keeps that magneto turning and you get spark and your vehicle goes. So that was pretty interesting that they simplified the truck to get them into production. Most of the trucks that were made by the United States and most of the vehicles stayed here. A small proportion went overseas, and we used French and British equipment.
And when was that, the time frame?
That would have been in 1917 and 1918. So you have U.S. troops wearing French helmets, maybe carrying French rifles and French machine guns, driving around in French vehicles, and it's just amazing from that standpoint.
Steve, we had a call come in.
Sure.
Do you recall any specific two-wheels vehicles like motorcycles built in Northern Ohio?
I don't recall any two-wheel vehicles, but I know that the AEF used motorcycles for its courier service, and the I'm more familiar with the World War II motorcycles, those specifically being your Indians and your Harleys, which were fantastic vehicles. And it's like if you can find one, you know, go for it. You know, if you're a motorcycle enthusiast. There were various manufacturers of in France, in England, in the United States, and to the best of my knowledge, they did buy a whole bunch of motorcycles. What the brand names were and what their performance was, that's not, you know, I don't have those facts on my fingertips today, but I could find out for you.
Okay, we have a call in here, and it's Tom from Cleveland. He has a question for you, Steve.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Tom, you coming through?
Not on the phone.
You're coming through now.
No.
Yeah, I can hear you, Tom.
There's a delay.
Wait a minute.
There's a delay. There's Tom's coming in loud and clear, but there may be a delay.
Fine. Thank you, Bernie, for tipping me off on this show. Because I'm very interested in your subject, and I'm thrilled to hear you, Steve Pressman, talking about the history of military vehicles. My active duty time in the Army was 72 to 84, and that was probably the last period of time of the quarter-ton truck, which we called the Jeep. And I'm pretty sure that vehicle was in the inventory for at least half a century when it finally phased out with the advent of the Humvee in 1990. But if I'm not mistaken, that was manufactured in Toledo, Ohio, at Willis Jeep.
It was the Willys for World War II. Yes, for World War II, so Willys Overland did manufacture the Jeeps. And then the M151s that we had, I was in during the same years you were. And those M151s were manufactured by various manufacturers, most likely by Ford Motor Company. And you'll be pleased to know that a new vehicle called the Growler, if you can remember the latest iterations of the M151 with the roll cage and all that other fun stuff, The Special Forces bought into the Growler because the Growler, which is about the same dimensions as the M151, will fit on an Osprey or a Chinook helicopter. And this gives the Special Forces a mobile vehicle capability that they can land a vehicle. You could put two M4s on a railroad car. You could put one Tiger on a railroad car. So when we had to ship all those tanks over, we had vehicles that not only could get around when they got to the battlefield, but we could get them to the battlefield. And that was more important than building the perfect vehicle. And certainly the Shermans were gasoline-powered vehicles, and they weren't very fast. We're talking, you know, you're doing 28 miles an hour, and it's breakneck speed. But for a tank, moving with a vehicle, that's it. And it was a change in there. And remember, we talked about these poor guys in the Revolutionary War. They're going 8 miles in a day. Infantrymen in World War II could go 8 or 12 or 15 miles in a day. Not much. When we fought the Battle of the Diluard Bridgehead in France in World War II, after D-Day, the armor broke through, the combat commands of the armored divisions broke through, and we were literally, our infantry was fighting the Germans in France when our armor, which were modern constituted forces, were already had reached Czechoslovakia. So it's just amazing what the vehicles will do for the situation. And when you're a Europe that has been under Nazi rule for 6 years, you know, fast isn't quick enough.
Well, that goes with the German blitzkrieg with the highways. They were far advanced than the U.S. was. In fact, weren't some of the highways copied after the Second World War here? That's when they put the Pennsylvania Turnpike in and everything else?
Yes, because they already existed in the 1930s. Keep in mind that the New York Road, before the Germans had the Autobahn, when you had to literally go on Route 322 all the way to New York. And my grandfather told me that in the 20s, you went up hills. You didn't have a really good first and second gear, so you went up hills in reverse.
Correct, and a lot of it had to do with the vacuum.
The vacuum and the gravity-fed fuel system, so right. Maybe I shouldn't complain about having to dog down my gas cap on my Subaru.
Well, they had to be very steep hills, probably 15, 16, well, over 16 degrees. Yeah, 18, you know, they weren't just hills. But
yeah, like Kittatinny and some of those hills. You know, when you hit those tunnels on the Penn Turnpike, you can see where they are, and you know that those also are choke points and that. And so what World War II, what it set a standard. You had the Jeep, you had the M4 tanks, you had the early versions of the Deuce and a Half, and they were Deuce and a Half, and they were amazing. When we got into World War II, and keep in mind, everything that we used in World War II, early in World War II, we were saddled with a lot of stuff for World War I. Like a hand grenade had old-fashioned black powder in it. If it got moisture in there, the thing wouldn't go boom. And so that's what they had to fight with in the Philippines. They had the Philippine campaign in 1942. December 7th, 1942, the Japanese attack the Pearl Harbor on the 7th. The Philippines gets attacked on the 8th. And they had the 26th Cavalry, was the last horse cavalry to be in combat.
They also used horses.
They also used horses. They were horse cavalry. And they had from Ohio, this has to do with Ohio, they had M3 tanks. And these were the early ones. These were the ones that would be the General Stuart tank, and they would you could open up, the driver and the co-driver could open up windows and get good ventilation. They had a 37-millimeter gun. They had very good roadability. They were a very versatile vehicle. But two companies left The 192nd and the 193rd armored companies were from Ohio. They were from the Milan area. So these guys were the first U.S. Armor to fight in World War I. They were from the Northeast Ohio. I guess you would say Milan would be more Northwest Ohio. It's closer to Toledo, so we can call it Northwest. But they were some of the first soldiers to actually engage the Japanese in World War II, and they used the light tanks. They had the advantages that nothing the Japanese had in the Philippines in 1942 would stand against an American tank. But as you know, nothing works without fuel or ammunition, and you had the fatigue and the wear and tear on the vehicles.
And which tank was built at the IX Center? That was the tank plant. Was that the M3?
During World War II, the tank that was built in the IX Center was the B-29 bomber, and it was after the war that became the tank plant and started building Korea War vintage M-41 Walker Bulldog tanks. And those were used up until they were used by the Ohio National Guard. We had them in the 107th in the 1950s in the Ohio National Guard, and then they were all transferred to the South Vietnamese Army. So what happens with vehicles is they last a good long time. We had vehicles that were built in like 1963 and 1964 that were used in 2003 in Iraq. That was one of the problems, that the vehicles were long in the tooth and they weren't functioning properly, and people got into trouble off of that. Whenever you have a lift mission or you're delivering cargo, you got to go. And your vehicle not turning over is not an excuse, because you're supposed to have these vehicles maintained. So that was an issue. But these vehicles they lasted 40 years.
Well, we have about 5 minutes left, but if anybody wants to call in, if they have another question, I know we had a few call-ins tonight, and there's only one line, so, it's be patient, and if you want to try back, you can, and call 440-775-8139, and this is WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio, and I'm Bernie Golias, your host for the Auto Era, and tonight's guest is Steve Pressman, and he's talking about military vehicle history, and I know we... just touched the surface on this topic tonight because, during that Second World War, they weren't really making automobiles, as we all know, and they were all the plants were changed over to military purposes. That's a whole history in itself, and the reasons why, and how William Knutson pulled everything together and made it happen to help win the Second World War, and it was a phenomenal team, and that's a whole story in itself with what they did there, getting the industry all put together as one major team, because there was a lot of apathy prior to that Second World War, because just after the First World War, no one wanted to get involved anymore. But, the thing is, with the vehicles, so many things were developed, and I'm going to turn it back over to Steve and let if there's any items you want to talk about here. We got a couple more minutes, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, it's an interesting aside is that my... During World War II, my grandfather was a sole support of a family, had two small children and a business. He wasn't exactly, they didn't want to take him because he was 35 years old. So he needed to get into he talked it over with my grandmother, and he decided to join the Army. And they wouldn't take him because he was old. But what he did was he wasn't in a important job. He wasn't a doctor. He wasn't a police officer, whatever. And unless you had a certain job, say like doctor, you couldn't buy a new car. New cars were available in 1943. You just couldn't buy them unless you were in a department of the War Department. What the War Department deemed as an essential occupation. And if you bought one, you got into trouble. And do you know what the punishment was, Bernie?
Tell us.
You had to go to the Army. So you know, sometimes we bemoan the the government, and the more things change, the more things they said they stayed the same. So basically, that was the system. If you were found with a new car, and it was a two banger for America, because not only did my grandfather get to serve in the United States Army as a medic, my grandmother was left with the business in the car, and she hired a guy to help her, a driving instructor, and she learned how to drive a car out of World War II. So there was a lot of not only developments with the technology in World War II, with the society. In other words, my grandmother, by the 1950s, she had the beehive hairdo and the big Chevy, and she was living the life of Riley, driving down the road. Thanks to what the system was during World War II, and that was it. And then, what I'd like to get into is basically, if I have a few minutes, is the philosophy during World War II. We touched on that we needed to move a lot of stuff overseas. So that's why the Jeeps were the size they were. That's why the tanks and the trucks were the size they were. So they would fit in standard ships. So we had like standardized cargo ships, like the Liberty ships. And so you'd size everything, and then you'd have standardized railroad cars in the country, and you'd size things to them. The philosophy was that the tanks were going to support the infantry, and the enemy armor would be dealt with by the tank destroyer. And those were towed artillery, and they were also vehicles that looked like tanks, like the M10. The M10 was called the Wolverine, and the M18, the most wonderful automotively vehicle in World War II, I think. A lot of these vehicles, they started out with high horsepower radial type engines, like aircraft engines, and you have the cylinders are in one plane around a circle, and they had high horsepower. So the tanks started out with those vehicles, and the Hellcat was a fast vehicle. It wasn't going 26 miles an hour. It was up to 40 miles an hour. It had thin armor. It didn't have a top on the turret, but it had a big 76 millimeter gun, and it could deal with most of the German armor. Where most of the tanks were the light tanks with their 37 millimeter guns in France in 1944, they didn't bother trying to shoot the German tanks. They loaded up with white phosphor rounds, and they tried to blind the German tanks. And then the Shermans would get behind them, especially EZ-8 with the high velocity 76 millimeter gun, and try to hit them in the rear. But it wasn't a one-on-one shot. And if you see the movie Fury, that's pretty accurate of what went down.
Well, I want to thank Steve for coming on the show tonight. He did a phenomenal job, and we're going to have you come back and talk some more about military vehicle history. But next week, the 22nd, I will not be on the show, obviously, if I'm not here. I won't be, but we're going to have someone fill in, but it won't be the auto era. So next Sunday, the auto era will not be on. And then on the 29th, depending on what the schedule is here with the school, we're going to have Tim Simonson on. He's going to talk about Model T Ford and local history in Lorain County. So with all that, also, where will I be? If someone just asked me, where will I be? Well, I'll be in Arizona attending the Grand National, the Antique Automobile Club of America Grand National. If you want to find out more about it, you can go to AACA. That's AACA.org, and check out the schedules there. But that's a lot of good things happening. Keep in mind also for June, we're going to have, for Northern Ohio, we talk about Northern Ohio automotive history. We're going to have the Cleveland All-Stars, and that's going to be a variety of different automobiles that are going to be at the Ursuline College. So keep in mind on that. Well, I always like to sign off with the song Drive My Car, because it's that time of year. So I look forward to talking to you in the next few weeks. And thanks for tuning in. And thank you, Steve, for being with us this evening.
You're very welcome. Thank you, and have a good evening.